Hey everybody, it's Jeff. Did you know that over a million people every week watch Your Move on late night television? Well, hold on, because that number's getting a whole lot bigger. Your Move is now expanding to 8 more cities across the U.S. For the first time ever, you can now find Your Move airing on CBS Friday nights after The Late Late Show with James Corden in Baltimore, Boston, Dallas, Miami, Minneapolis, and San Francisco. Whoa! And you can also find new Your Move broadcasts on NBC after SNL, now airing in Seattle, Washington, and coming to Nashville, Tennessee in September. With these additions, you can now find Your Move on late night TV in 34 cities. You can be part of this unprecedented expansion in two ways. First, stay up to date with our latest TV schedule using the Your Move app, and spread the word to the people in your life who could use some better decisions. Second, consider supporting Your Move with a tax-deductible donation. It's the generosity of people like you that brings Your Move to more people in more cities. So visit yourmove.is and click Give. That's yourmove.is and look for the Give button. It only takes a couple of minutes to spread the word or donate. Thank you. We really do believe that the next 30 minutes will help you make better decisions and live with fewer regrets. So today, we're going to hear a message from Andy called Skin in the Game. In this week's episode, Andy hosts a candid conversation about race, racism, and faith in America.
The title of today's message is Skin in the Game, a candid, as you're about to see, a candid conversation about race, racism, and faith. And to participate in the conversation with me today, would you please welcome two gentlemen who are not strangers to our community, Joseph Sojourner and Sam Collier. Thanks, guys. To get started today, what I thought I would do is just give each of you a couple of minutes, 2 or 3 minutes, to kind of give us the highlights of your story. And one other thing the audience needs to know, I invited two police officers to be a part of this conversation as well, as you guys know. In fact, one of them is a mutual friend of all three of ours. And understandably, they could not participate in a panel discussion because it would look as if they were representing the city where they were policemen. They would be representing the entire city, which is not fair, which makes sense. But they gave us some great information, and we're going to try to take some of that information and bring it into the discussion. So real quick, just a little bit about each of you, then we'll jump right in.
I was born and raised in Akron, Ohio, and right around third grade, my family moved to the suburbs, and we were the first blacks to go to the school that we went to in Talmadge. And so it was this journey I had all throughout my childhood of dealing with some bullying, but also seeing some really, really great people. So I think I've always had this, I've always seen the good and the bad. And then since then, I've been able to move here to Atlanta, really get a chance to work with students, now traveling and communicating to students abroad. So really, really a privilege and honor to be here today.
Sam?
I have a twin sister, and we got adopted at 2 months old. Our mother was addicted to crack cocaine. Dad was addicted to crack cocaine, and she was prostituting for a while. And at age 21, she had 3 kids, and then she had me and my twin sister, which makes 5 kids at age 21 on poverty, welfare. So she had to give us up for adoption. Then I graduated from high school, went into ministry, and started a nonprofit. Started working a lot with Martin Luther King's family and just learning Dr. King's philosophy in our nonprofit. Reached about 80,000 kids in these impoverished areas, just teaching them that they can win by changing their mind. And here we are today.
Yeah. Isn't that great? When you were growing up, did your parents say, hey, now if you get pulled over, do this, do that, talk slow?
Absolutely.
Were you given a script?
Yeah, when you're raised, my mother was very, very clear. You're never to talk back. You make sure you always adhere to what they're saying. You never want to resist arrest. And then if they ask you to show your wallet, you want to really ask them to get your wallet.
Sam?
I think for me, I am definitely very, very, very cautious around police in general, especially white police officers. And if I'm afraid of anything, it is of what the situation will escalate to. You just never know what that day is going to be. And I know we spoke. I got pulled over last week, just out of nowhere for going 30 in a 30. And You know.
Now, he didn't say that. He didn't say, no, son, didn't you were going 30 and a 30. No. What did he say?
He said, you're going 40. I said, well, I was going 27. And I knew that I was going 27 because it was one of those neighborhoods, one of those white neighborhoods that you ride through very slow. Because you know that, you know, there's money over here, so on and so forth. And pulled over immediately, hey, sir, I said, I wasn't going 40. Okay, step out the car, step out the car. Walk in a straight line. Okay, your eyes are moving. We think you're drunk. It's 9:30. I'm not drunk. I'm in ministry. And okay, we didn't find anything. Get back in the car. And so I'm very cautious about those situations because it could just turn into anything. And like Joseph definitely have heard, okay, you just do whatever they want you to do. I mean, don't.
See, when I was raising my kids, I've raised three kids. We have a wonderful foster daughter that we love. And so I've taught four kids to drive, essentially. Yeah. And here's what I told my white kids. I said, if you get pulled over by the police, just make sure you're out of the way so you're not blocking traffic. That's all I told them.
Wow.
Because that's what white people tell their kids, because what else is there to say? I mean, the police officer's going to smile and be friendly and check you out and then give you a ticket. And so the reason I bring it up is because this is part of the thing. I mean, this is part of early on, there's an expectation, be on the lookout, watch out. You know, in my family, it's like the police are your friends. When you see police, it's a good thing. And so this goes to this tension that starts early. You want to say something?
Yeah, there was right in college time, there was a debate happening between myself and some friends, and they were white and they were a group of blacks. And we said, hey, just to make a point, you all get in one car, we'll all get in another car, and we'll drive through some neighborhoods and see what happens. So they got in one car, we got in another car. And sure enough, we start driving through some neighborhoods that we live in. And so within about 15 minutes, our car gets pulled over and their car is okay, but they stop and then they come back and talk to the officers as to why they pulled us over. And I think what I remember most about the moment was I was surprised at how free they were to ask the police questions, because this was something that we were always told you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to speak forth. You're not allowed to say or insist what your rights are. You're supposed to be quiet and make sure you do as you're told and not make any sudden movements. And I think that was a really, really pillar moment in my life where I really saw, geez, it's so different how they have such freedom to be able to do that. And like I said, I don't have tons of negative experiences with it, but I do remember that moment so, so clearly. And I remember for them, the conversations that happened after that were just really, really incredible for us to be able to really open up and say, hey, didn't know that that would happen like that. But reality is, if we hop in a car, I mean, even when I'm working with high school students and I'm seeing pictures of road trips, I'm thinking we would never even think you can a group of black people can hop in a car and try and drive across states and see if it, because the road trip would turn into a bunch of roadblocks. And so that type of thought isn't even an option for us. So it's really cool to say, wow, that it's fun to be able to do that, but I wish we would. But there is this idea that unfortunately it's just not
so
the reality.
So why? I mean, in your opinion, I mean, I'm just asking, you don't represent all the black people in the world. I don't represent all the white people in the world. Some people think I do sometimes, but I don't. It's just me. So, but why? And we're going to get to some details in a minute, but we're right here at this point of tension. I mean, this is a reality. You're not making this up. We talked to several police officers, black and white, to get information. We want to, you know, make sure all the perspectives are here. And you and I have a mutual friend who's a black policeman downtown.
He educated us.
and lots of information. And he admitted, as a black police officer, when I see a group of black, especially young men, packed in a car, an SUV or truck, he said, I kind of assume the worst. My mind just goes there.
Well, can I keep it real? Can we?
No, let's keep it on the surface, and let's get out of this unscathed, okay? Yeah. No, go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of us get penalized for a few of us.
Say that again?
A lot of us get penalized for a few of us. And what I mean by that is this. A lot of officers and people of the opposite race get their cues on what we are like as African Americans from hip-hop or from what the media portrays us to be, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, as we talked about this earlier, to our friend that's an undercover narcotics agent, 70% of the crime that's happening in these areas, crack cocaine, weed, so many different things, are African-American males and men. But that's just a small section of
African-American men, yeah.
But unfortunately, it affects all of us. And we get categorized, and they expect us to be just like them, and you know, and So that's, I think that's what.
And it's not that way with white people.
It's not. If a white person,
if a white person acts out, I don't think, oh my gosh, what are people going to think of the white people? I've never had that thought.
No, probably don't have that thought.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, that's a.
And you're truly left thinking, gosh, how this person acts will be a reflection of how I'm acting. And a lot of times you see things change when one person has a negative outcome. And so whether it's hip hop or whether it's something that's been seen or whether it's someone at a restaurant, it is something that we're always cautious about, especially in college campuses. You see someone acting up, you think, gosh, how is this going to affect me tomorrow? So you're instantly connected as minorities, knowing that their actions will probably impact you.
Now I got to move to this next question.
Sorry.
This is kind of a long question. Most of us, from where we sit as white people, we are far away from what you're talking about. We just are. We believe you. I mean, it's a reality, but it's still so far away, and it just, our answers, our emotional response is so simplistic. The closer you get to a problem, the more complex it becomes, because the closer you get to any problem, there's the actual fact. So, culturally speaking, white people, for the most part, are so far away from this. We just want to say, well, look, if you would just behave yourself and do what the police ask, none of this would happen.
Yeah.
Okay, which is an oversimplification, because we're so far away. So, what can you say to help bring us closer? Because we're not, you know, there's going to be cultural divides. There are going to be things that we always wrestle with. But surely there is a way to be brought closer so that when we see these incidents on television and we see these things where we don't want to rush to judgment, but we want to be compassionate and we're kind of caught in the middle. What could you do to bring us a bit closer emotionally?
I would say really start walking through life with someone of color or a minority, and I think you begin to see the day-to-day narratives that they'll say that might be shocking, that you might say, I didn't even know these thoughts were crossing your mind. I didn't even know you're thinking those things or even going through the situations that you were going through. It's not just white people who look in their distant, but black people and other minorities could look at another group the same way. That when I'll say I work with a lot of white students and I'll say, hey, they're wealthy and they're going through so many problems, a black person could look at me and say, what problems could a wealthy white kid actually go through? And I imagine if I say that, some of you in this room would think that's the most crazy, ridiculous statement you could probably ask, because our kids are going through so much. But reality is they're distant, and to them it looks simple because you have everything you could possibly ask for. You have a great house, you have all this opportunity. Like, what problems could you truly have? And I'll look at them right in the eyes the same way that might be on the other side and say, there's so many real problems that they're facing that are identical to your kids. And so it's interesting. I feel like we all know the answer to that question, that when you get closer to somebody, you begin to see that there's not that many things that are different. But unfortunately, from a distance, it's easy to make easy assumptions that are convenient. So that's one thing I would say.
Anything on that?
I would say this, and this might be a hard statement, but I think that it's important to remember that the African-American community has been in a state of emergency since the Civil Rights Movement. It's very important. And that's not putting the blame on you. You did this, you did race. No. That is understanding that our community as a whole is playing catch up in a lot of different areas. Education, economic empowerment, so on and so forth. Systematic racism, all these other things, strategies that were placed in our own community that we all know about, that was to tear apart our families and so many other things. And so when you have that, we are at a disadvantage in a sense, and now we are catching up. I think sometimes the tendency is to just think, oh, y'all just like us. It's America.
Right. No, that's exactly right. It's like, get with it. Come on, step up, get in the game, you know. I get that. Let me ask my longest question, okay? Because this is sort of at the heart of why I wanted to have this conversation. In 1967, during a lecture or a sermon, Dr. King is said to have said this: in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Many white people, including me, are silent because sometimes we just don't know what to say. So, what should we say? What can we say in situations where we don't know all the facts? And here's a fundamental difference, I think. You speak into this. The fundamental difference is, I trust the police. And I trust the criminal justice system. I just do. So when I see something on television that looks like, oh my gosh, how could they do that? I think to myself, well, they're going to get to the bottom of it and justice will be done. How do we not fall silent as your friend When in fact, again, there's this tension.
So I would say this. When someone says, I'm waiting on the facts, it immediately makes someone like me feel like, is that saying that I'm not acknowledging the facts? When someone says, okay, we'll look at the facts, it immediately makes you say, well, what facts are you looking at? Because reality is, I've been looking at this time and time again. So when you isolate it to just one incident, say, let's just narrow it down to this one incident, we would say, but you're missing all the other facts. And I've been seeing all the other facts. So when you say, I'm just going to look at this fact for this one incident, we would say, well, what about the reason as to why there is horrible education? What about the reason as to why this person was selling CDs? What about the reason why there is poverty in these communities, or why there's broken homes and all these other scenarios that might have led up to this? So more or less, we're looking at this larger narrative that these to us are all the facts. These are all the facts that will continue to lead to these actions being had over and over and over again. So when they say, well, let's just look at the fact of this one case, we'll say, well, that's not going to solve the issue, because the issue lies in all the facts. And that's why I think there's this tension of, when can we get to all the facts so we can begin to truly start repairing?
So it's collective anger, it's collective grief, it's collective in the black community. In the white community, I'm looking at that incident that just happened thinking, well, let's just wait and collect the facts and see what happens. And that is a huge disconnect. Yeah. We talked to a couple of police officers, as again, I invited them. And here's what two officers, they almost told me identical things, a black officer, a white officer. They said this. They said, one thing that I would say if I were on the panel is, and this is so specific, so specific, but it needs to be said, so you react to this. They said, we just want people to know that the number one thing we want when we walk into a situation is we want control. We want to control the situation. Sometimes our presence, just the presence of a police officer, controls the situation. From presence, we go to speaking. We use words. We tell people what to do. We need them to do what we've asked them to do. If they don't do what we've asked them to do, then we are given permission to manhandle people, because we have to get in control of the situation. If that doesn't work, we can tase people. We can use other ways of physical force. The last thing we want to do is draw a gun, because when we draw a gun, because of training, generally it's going to get used. As our buddy said, it's not going to go back in. That's what he says. If it comes out, it's not going to go back in. So it's control the situation. As things elevate, the response elevates. And what both of these officers said is, if people would just understand, don't ask us questions, don't ask us to explain things, don't tell us their rights. We know all of that. Just do what we ask you to do. And if there's a problem, you can report us. And it goes on our file forever. Now, as a white person, you know, who's raised white kids, I think that's great. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, we're all done. Just do what the police say, and if it's a problem, we'll go down there and file a report. So, again, as black men who have been raised in a different environment than perhaps my kids were or I was in terms of respect or, you know, fear of the police, how do you respond to that? Because both of these gentlemen were like, please, 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 let that be known. Because from their perspective, this is at the heart of so many of these situations. Is that oversimplification from your experience, or how do you respond to that?
You know, I wouldn't say it's oversimplification. I mean, I like to think that, and I like to believe it, because I do believe a majority of police officers are wonderful. I would be slightly hesitant to truly trust that reporting an officer is going to do much, just because you don't really hear that happening. I do think in the end, there's a slight level of distrust of believing that if I were to go down, or if my whole family were to go down and say, hey, they walked in our house, pushed us all to the floor, and really were just too aggressive towards us, and you see that officer out again, and even if 10 more families did it, I think that the narrative in the inner city community is, it doesn't matter how many inner city people walk down there and say that this person is pushing them around every single day of the week. That does not, their voices are still not heard. You're dealing with a people who feel like they're not being heard, and I do think that that's where it kind of comes from, a feeling like, yes, you can come down and report them, and it'll be in their file, but what happens next? I mean, is that really going to change anything? Because if it was your child and they were coming home every day saying that they were being bullied, just like I was in the fifth grade, and here I was being bullied every single day, pushed around, kicked, punched, and the teacher saw it, and they were trying their best to protect me, but they knew they couldn't protect me. And then there was that day where the kid just pushed me too far, and I wasn't having my best moment in the fifth grade, and I threw that board down, and I ran over, and I grabbed him, and I swung at him, and that teacher pulled me out, and she looked
me in the
eyes.
Suddenly, you're the problem.
And I'm the problem, and she had a choice. She could have said, let's look at the facts, but thank the Lord she didn't, because she knew the larger picture, and she said, how long are you going to let their words control you? And if this was a movie, and we were seeing a kid get pushed around, and the dignity beat out of him every single day, we would say he needs to eventually stand up, but when you're looking at your child, and you know you can never tell them that, that's where the anger stems from.
Wow. Let's turn a corner real quick. You're both Christians. You're both Christian leaders. You love God. The thing that we for sure have in common is a common faith and a common Savior. And one of the things that I think most Christians don't know, and I can't even help you fully appreciate, is that at the birth of Christianity 2,000 years ago, there was extraordinary, off-the-chart racial division potentially within the church. And it wasn't between two groups. It was between five groups. There were Jews who looked down on everybody. There were Gentiles who thought the Jews believed they were better than everybody. There were slaves, which were slaves. There was a group called freedmen who used to be slaves, who bought their way out of slavery or earned their way out of slavery or behaved their way out of slavery. The slaves hated the freedmen. The slave owners never respected the freedmen even though they were given citizenship. And then there were women who had absolutely no rights at all. And all five of these groups began to follow Jesus, and they all showed up at church, and somehow they managed to work through and move beyond extraordinary division at every level, you know, financially, culture, respect. I mean, geographically, where a person lived, if you were the majority versus the minority, it went on and on and on. And they were able to work through this. You look at the extraordinary racism in certain parts of our country, even certain parts of our state, and you think, you know, it's cyclical. All these people are in a cycle. They're raised to think a certain way, behave a certain way. And my illustration is Peter. Peter, if you're Catholic, you know, he's like the first pope. If you're not Catholic, Peter's the leader of the local church or leader of the church, the first century. 15 years, think about this. 15 years after the resurrection, 15 years after, I mean, Peter's heard it all, seen it all, walked with Jesus, seen the empty tomb, the whole deal, had breakfast after the resurrection with Jesus. Peter, 15 years after the resurrection, still does not like Gentiles, still thinks they're inferior. I mean, it was a racial divide. One day, God interrupts Peter's, you know, quiet time and says, I want you to go up the coast and I want you to go into the home of a Gentile and tell them about Jesus. And Peter's like, okay, you know, I've never been in a Gentile's home. Well, I don't do that. I don't go in their home. They don't go in my home. This is Peter. So he ends up, he goes up the coast. He's about to go into the home of Cornelius. And here's where the story picks up. Acts and Luke tells us this. While talking with Cornelius, Peter went inside. And I think he stood at the threshold of their door and took a deep breath and thought, maybe I can just hold my breath and get out of here without breathing any Gentile air. Peter went inside and he found a large gathering of people. So there's a lot. This is Cornelius has invited his whole family, you know, the friends, neighbors, everybody's packed in this house of this pretty wealthy guy. And listen to what he says out loud. This is stuff you think you don't say this out loud. Here's the opening remark. They're silent. Here's Peter. He's the guy that knew Jesus. We're about to get it from the horse's mouth. Here's what he said. And he said to them, you are well aware that as everybody here knows, that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile. But look at this next line. But it's actually worse. But God has shown me that I should not call anyone impure or unclean. In other words, up until this moment, I considered you impure and you unclean. But God has shown me I shouldn't call you that anymore. And you're thinking, well, I feel so much better now. So God had to tell you that, but what that says to me is God may have told you, but you don't believe it because you've spent your entire life thinking I am impure and unclean. But God has shown me. Now we're going to change the focus of the letters. But God has shown me. But God has shown me. In other words, God has done something on the inside of me, and now I see differently than I did before. But God has shown me that I should not call anyone impure or unclean. God had to show Peter. And finally, Peter got it. And God had to expose something inside of Peter for Peter to get it. And then the coolest thing happens. About 5 years later, there's this big meeting in Jerusalem. And finally, the church officially unhitches from an Old Testament way of thinking that would have divided Jews and Gentiles forever. We would not be here. And what's so fascinating in the book of Acts, chapter 15, both groups make not just theological and religious concessions, both groups made cultural concessions in order for there to be unity in the church. It's how the gospel survived the first century. And I say all that to say this, there's hope. I mean, these seem to be unanswerable questions. This seems to be, hey, it's been fun, we've talked about it, but we're all gonna go home and nothing's gonna change. But we know it changed once, because we are products of the change that took place 2,000 years ago. So with all that, you know, as sort of a backdrop, how do you guys own the problem as Christians? And then what would you say to predominantly white congregation and white churches in terms of what we need to own in terms of our Christianity?
I think one of the things that's so powerful, and I hope this is answering the question, it might be indirectly, but I just feel like we are righting the wrongs of history on this stage today. And I'm so excited that we're doing it here in the church. And I think for me as a Christian, the question is what does love require of me? And that's the question I have to ask myself every day.
Unfortunately, we know the answer to that question, don't we?
It requires for us to come together. And the quote that I want to use from Dr. King says this. He said, most men hate each other because they fear each other. They fear each other because they don't know each other. They don't know each other because they're not in relationship.
There's a difference learning from someone and truly saying, I want to just learn about someone, but truly saying, I want to walk through life with you. I want to learn as much as I can learn. And then we can have these authentic conversations. And sometimes everything isn't said perfectly, but we're not looking at each other's words because we're focused on each one of our hearts. And we know that we can trust each other's hearts. And that's why we can have this authentic conversation. We have two tasks, love God, love our neighbors. And even though sometimes our neighbors aren't the easiest to love, it's our task, it's our duty to continue to love them, learn from them, so that we can learn how to love them even better.
The thing that allowed the church to impact the world was a group of people that had every justification in the world decided to put those aside for the sake of something more important, and that was unity around a message that had the potential to change the world. And the reason, and you guys said it, the reason the church has to be at the epicenter of this discussion and at the epicenter of this movement is this. Only in the church are we taught that I'm looking at someone who is made in the image of God, that you are made in the image of God, and you cannot mistreat my children and get along with me, and I cannot mistreat you and get along with my Father in heaven. That is the message of the New Testament, and that is the message of the cross, and that trumps my experience, and it trumps your experience, and it trumps what I've experienced, what my family has experienced, what I've heard, and all of the things that break my heart in terms of what's going on in culture. We have the message, we have the leverage, and if you're a Christian, what you don't have is an excuse.
Thanks so much for listening to Your Move and for helping us spread the word about our biggest expansion yet. And don't forget that you can help Your Move reach more people in more cities by making a gift. Visit yourmove.is and click Give to Donate. That's yourmove.is. Thank you.